Hello and welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Each week we look at a new sports book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author. This week my guest is physicist and sports fan John Eric Goff. We are discussing his book, Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Sports science fascinates me. Most likely, learning how difficult sports really are, from a scientific standpoint, gives me some consolation about my own limited athletic ability. Add to that the fact that I'm not very good with science either, and a book like Gold Medal Physics is doubly intriguing. Eric's book offers plenty of insights into how athletes' bodies function, how balls fly, and how the physical world, whether air or water or mountains, works against them. And if there is a lesson from the book and our interview, it is that this physical side of sports is very complex and very hard. I think this is an important lesson. In the current world of sports overanalysis, we often hear commentators say that an athlete's inability to perform a certain move was due to a mental lapse or a failure of the will. A quarterback makes a brilliant throw to win a game, and we hear how he wanted to win. A gymnast fails to stick a landing, and we're told that she lost her focus. By looking at the physics of athletic accomplishments, Eric reminds us of the remarkable strength and dexterity and timing and luck that are involved. I learned a lot from Eric's book, and I enjoyed visiting with him about it. So let's turn to the interview. Eric, welcome to New Books in Sports. Thank you for joining me on the program.
Glad to be with you, Bruce.
So let's start by having you say a few words about yourself. You have a great line in your preface where you say that you get as giddy about learning something new in your work as a physicist as you did when you got a hit while playing in Little League. So why don't you tell us about your background in physics and your background in sports and how you brought these two interests together?
I'd love to. I've always been a sports fan. I played baseball when I was a kid. Loved baseball, followed it major league level and played all Little League and into early high school, and had a dream of becoming a professional baseball player. I pitched and played third and short, and I wasn't bad, but came to the realization probably around 10th grade that I didn't have quite the chops it took to make it to the major league level. And I always tell people I'm probably one of the few people on the planet who chose physics because something else was more difficult. And hitting a baseball thrown at you at 95 miles an hour with a lot of spin is probably a little tougher than solving the Schrodinger equation. So I love science and I love mathematics, and I really got into physics late in high school and then carried that into my undergraduate years at Vanderbilt. So it's just been a blessing for a career to be able to combine the love of physics and sports and eventually put all that passion into a book.
So I'll say that, you know, I would get excited when I got hits in Little League Baseball, too. I didn't have the same excitement with physics. In fact, when I took a university physics class as a freshman, I got a C. So I'll warn you that some of my questions are going to be pretty dumb based on my lack of knowledge of physics. So,
well, the only question that's dumb is the unasked one. So this coming year will mark 20 years that I've been teaching at the introductory physics level, and I also teach advanced physics level in my college. But I've met many, many first-timers to physics, and they are always shying away from asking good questions, and I welcome any kind of question you can ask me.
Okay. Well, I think after reading your book, I think I would have done better in university physics if I had had you as a professor instead of the person I did have. So I particularly like the structure of the book, and I'll explain to listeners that in each chapter of the book, you focus on a famous event in recent sports history, and you branch off from that event to introduce principles of physics and then explain what happened in that event based on those principles. So in the book's first chapter, for instance, you look at the play, capital T, capital P, when Cal beat Stanford in the final kickoff return in 1982, and you use that play to then introduce concepts of force and velocity and vectors. You talk about Katarina Witt. You talk about Al Order throwing the discus. So different chapters or different scenes that sports fans will be familiar with, and then you explain the physics behind that. But I want to talk with or start with your second chapter, which looks at Doug Flutie's last-second pass to beat the University of Miami in 1984. And what
just,
I found,
just to be more specific, the third chapter is Doug Flutie, and the second is the play.
Oh, okay. Sorry about
I've
that.
I've got a kind of an introductory opening first chapter, but yeah, chapter three takes us into 1984 and Doug Flutie's Hail Mary.
Okay. So what I was particularly interested with that was your discussion of the flight of the football. And so can you tell us what questions you were trying to answer as a physicist in your analysis of that the flight of the pass?
Well, just to be clear about analyzing great sports moments with physics, in no way do I want your listeners or anyone who ever picks up a book on sports physics to think that, you know, a scientist is trying to come along and dehumanize or put all these great events into equations and make them a little more black and white on a piece of paper. The idea is to sit there and enjoy the majesty of Flutie's Hail Mary and enjoy it over and over and over again. And then sometime later, when you've recovered from the awe of seeing that, to think about the fact that this quarterback was not exactly the NFL prototype. Now, his counterpart that day, Bernie Kosar, was tall, you know, big arm and all that. And Flutie did have a good NFL career, but he used his talent, he maximized his talent based on the body he was given. And it boggled my mind that he could actually throw the ball as far as he did. And in a bit of a rain, a little bit of a headwind. So when I looked at that play over and over again, I tried to understand exactly how it was he could sling that ball about 62 yards down the field.
Mm-hmm. So you looked at the length of the pass, and but then you were also looking at some more specific elements of the throw, like the angle of the pass as it leaves his hand, the speed of the pass as it's as he throws it.
That's right, and when he took the snap, of course, they're a ways down from the end zone, and he's got to give his receivers time to get down the field. So he's got to scramble a little bit, and the receivers had made it almost to the end zone, and he unleashes the ball, and it's in the air about 3 seconds. And I calculated that the ball left his hand around 60 miles an hour. So, you know, next time you're in your car and you're on the interstate and you're going 60 miles an hour, that's about what the ball left Flutie's hand. And it's a beautiful spiral. It left about 38 degrees up from the horizontal and made a very nice, almost parabolic arc. And it turns out when you do that problem as you would have done it in your university physics, when you didn't have any air around, you get an answer that's not too far removed from the real answer by putting the air back into the problem. So even a first-year physics student could have done a pretty good job analyzing that throw. Mm-hmm. But, you know, about 60 miles an hour at 38 degrees, and 3 seconds later, it's a celebration like Boston College probably had never seen.
Yeah. So I can't hold up the diagrams that you have in your book of the past, but I'm going to kind of plot them out myself. And so for people who are listening to this while driving, don't repeat this. And I'm going to start right. I'm going to violate a rule of making physics diagrams by starting on the right side, because in the clips he throws from right to left. And so what was the horizontal distance of the pass?
It was about 62 yards down the field.
Okay, so 62 yards. And it was in the air. How long did you say? 3 seconds?
About 3 seconds.
3 seconds. Okay. So, and it was, what was the degrees? I actually have a protractor.
About 38 degrees.
38 degrees. Okay. So I can do that. Okay. All right. And I actually know how to make curves and tangents. So I'm drawing a parabola, the arc of a parabola. Okay. So now, as you explain in the book, this is how it would look if he threw the ball in a vacuum.
That's right.
Okay. So 3 seconds, 62 yards. And then what was the height of the pass, the maximum height it would have reached?
It went about 36 feet, I believe. So, okay. You know, about 12 yards, you know, which is a little more than a first down in horizontal distance.
Okay.
Now, in vacuum, he could have let the ball go around 53 miles an hour.
Okay.
The 60-mile-an-hour throw is because there's air in the problem.
Okay. All right. So he threw it – he actually threw it about 60 miles per hour. And
yeah,
now
you could have gotten it there at 53 miles an hour in the same amount of time had there not been any air around.
Okay. So the one thing I want to do now, so I've got my nice perfect parabola, but then you also show how the path changed, because then you add in the air resistance. And as you talked about, he threw it into a headwind.
That's right. And the ball with a very nice spiral has relatively small air resistance. Had the ball been one of these wobbly ducks, it would obviously have a lot more air resistance because it'd have a less aerodynamic shape to it. But a well-thrown spiral actually makes it through the air with a fairly small amount of air drag.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true for things like baseballs and cricket balls and soccer balls.
Mm-hmm. So in looking at the diagram you do, where you add in the air resistance, so the path of the ball goes somewhat higher at the top.
That's right. He'd have to release it at a slightly larger angle to reach the same point.
Okay. So then what surprised me is that it still does stick more or less to the arc of a parabola. I had thought, with my limited physics knowledge, that the arc of the ball going into the wind, but then also with gravity playing upon it, was that it would be more like a more like the arc of a fly ball, you know, where it climbs up and then it has a steeper descent?
That's right, but don't forget that fly ball that you see has a lot of backspin on it, typically.
Oh, okay. So
that affects the flight.
Oh, okay, all right. So I thought that flight would be more of just kind of the dying speed of the ball as it's going through the air.
Well, the air is working on the ball to slow it down, and that removes some energy. You can take away a little bit of the spin. But certainly a baseball has a lot of backspin, and so does a well-hit golf drive. So the trajectories tend to rise up and then fall much steeper on the way down.
Okay. So that was something I was going to ask you as well, and you talk about this in a book, that a football in a tight spiral is pretty aerodynamic, and you just mentioned this, whereas a baseball is not.
That's right. A baseball, being much more spherical in shape, doesn't have a nice nose cone forward. It's not anywhere near as aerodynamically shaped as a football.
Okay. So then jumping ahead, I want to stick with the physics of flying balls, but jumping ahead to something that you talk about in a later chapter is that you mentioned that if a baseball didn't have laces, we wouldn't have as many home runs as we do now.
That's correct. In fact, that is counterintuitive for a lot of people.
Yeah, I know. I was surprised by that. Why is that?
People would, if you put a smooth ball and a rough ball, I think a reasonable guess would be that the smooth ball would be more aerodynamic, that the air could go over it a little easier, let's say. It turns out that that's not true for a lot of objects in certain speed ranges. Now, if you get really fast, like an airplane, there's no advantage to putting stitches or dimples on an airplane. You know, it's nice and smooth for the most part. Now, for sports like baseball and soccer and golf, those surface rough features definitely aid in the distance the balls can go. So for a baseball, if you imagine, you know, a home run is hit around 400 feet, you're going to drop 10 to 15% of that distance without the stitches. Huh. So 340 to 360 feet or so, you know, again, depending on wind and spin and all these other factors. But imagine if most of the 400 hit balls only went 340 feet. You'd see a lot of fly ball outs, or they'd have to redesign the stadium.
So if they add, you know, we always hear this debate about lively balls and dead balls and so forth. So if they added more texture to the surface area, that would actually increase the number of home runs that are hit.
It could. But I'm not a person that wants to mess with the magical 108 double stitches.
So, but this is an issue that came up last summer with the 2010 World Cup. And during the tournament, there were complaints from players about the new ball that had been designed by Adidas. And I had read some reactions to the player complaints that basically said, you know, get over it, players. It's just a ball. Use it. And but from a physics standpoint, there was an explanation as to why the ball was complaining, or excuse me, why the ball was behaving in unexpected ways and the players were complaining.
That's right. The Jabalani ball was definitely a hot topic last summer. And each time the World Cup rolls around every 4 years for the men, you get a brand new ball. And in 2002, when the World Cup was played in Japan and Korea, they had the Fevernova ball. And that was a standard 32-panel ball that a lot of us have played with. You can buy these fairly cheaply in a store, not necessarily the Fevernova brand. But in 2006, when the World Cup moved to Germany, Adidas introduced the Teamgeist ball. And that was a different beast. That had 14 thermally bonded panels instead of 32 stitched panels, you know, the standard hexagons and pentagons. Mm-hmm. And that reduced the amount of roughness on the ball. And what came along last year with the Jabalani ball was even further reduction in the panels to 8 thermally bonded panels. So if you keep making the ball smoother and smoother and smoother, it changes the aerodynamics of the ball, and the players are going to notice that right away, especially at the elite levels where, you know, matters of inches are noticeable by the top athletes. So what Adidas did was they put intentional roughness on the ball. If you look at a Jabalani ball and you look at the surface, you will see they have intentionally added grooves to that ball. And they did that with the purpose of getting it roughly as rough as previous balls so that the flight dynamics would be comparable, so the players wouldn't notice anything too out of the ordinary. Now, every World Cup, when there's a new ball, there are grumblings, especially from the goalkeepers, about the new ball. The Jabalani was certainly different from the Teamgeist ball. The flight dynamics of a soccer ball are quite interesting. If you have a very slow hit ball, let's say 20 miles an hour, the amount of air drag on it isn't terribly large, but something happens between about 20 and 45 miles an hour to drop the amount of drag that you would have for a given speed. In fluid dynamics, we call this the drag crisis. Got to have these fancy names. After that, you have a fairly stable amount of drag, and it's proportional to roughly the square of the speed. So what I like to tell people is if you're in your car and you stick your hand out the window and you're going 30 miles an hour and you kind of feel a certain force on the hand, you go 60 miles an hour, you double your speed, you're going to feel about 4 times the force. So what happened was the Jabalani ball came in with less drag than the Teamgeist ball for a given speed. So a lot of these really hard-hit free kicks and corner kicks and smashes from from just outside the box that the goalies were having to contend with actually had less air drag. You couple that with the fact that about half the venues in South Africa last year were played at very high elevation, meaning the air density is a little smaller, and there's even less drag. So those balls were really moving, and goalies noticed it.
So was it just speed that was the problem, or were they behaving erratically in some way when they were flying?
There was an issue of an erratic motion of the ball. Even balls that do not spin can actually move side to side a little. This is what kept Phil Niekro pitching almost to 50. If you can throw a knuckleball, it has very little spin on it. And if you can get one side of the ball to have a stitch and the other side of the ball to have a smooth area, you can make the ball curve. You can make it wobble a little bit. And what happens with the Jabulani ball is even if it's kicked without spin, there was a little more wobble to it than the ball they used 4 years ago, the Teamgeist ball. So the instability with the forces on the ball was a little greater last year than it was before. So there was some erratic motion. There was some wobbling that was new for the goalies.
So I want to stick with soccer balls for a second because you have a chapter on David Beckham and his famous free kicks, and you explain how it's possible or how Beckham is able to bend it when he gives a free kick. So how does he do that? How does the ball move? Like, as you show in the book, it basically moves like the curve of a banana.
That's right. The ball has to have an appreciable amount of side spin. So if you imagine a ball sitting on the ground and you're going to go kick it, if you kick it right through the center, you're not going to spin it. If you kick it a little off center, you can make the ball spin. Now, there's a little bit of a compromise there because the more off center you get, the more you can spin it, but the less speed you can give it. So the professional athletes, especially the elite ones like Beckham back in his prime, knew optimally where to put the foot, or as they would say, the boot on the ball, and just enough off-center to have enough speed and just enough off-center to have enough spin to make these fantastic curved kicks. So the ball would have a lot of side spin. So it's moving through the air. Say you're looking down on it, it would be spinning counterclockwise for a right-footed kicker like Beckham. What you imagine is on the left side of the ball, as you're looking down on it, the air gets whipped around behind it a little more than on the right side of the ball. And it's completely analogous to a boat rudder. If you're looking out the back of a boat and you look down at the rudder, if it's nice and straight, the water just passes by roughly the same on each side of the boat, and you go straight. If you turn the rudder, left or right, it's not symmetric anymore. Water gets deflected one way or the other. And Newton, more than 300 years ago, told us, hey, if an object feels a force from a second object, well, the second object's got to feel the same size force, but in the opposite direction. And that's what happens on the soccer ball. If the ball's able to whip the air off asymmetrically, so not just right behind it, but maybe slightly to the right for Beckham, the air gives it a little push to the left. And that's what happens with these great corner free kicks, is you see this big curving bend off to the left for a right-footed kicker like Beckham.
And one of the things you also talk about in that section is you fed in a bunch of data into a computer, right, to do calculations and how to kind of predict the rate of success for someone like Beckham in aiming for the upper left corner of the net on a free kick.
That's right. A colleague of mine, Matt Carey, in University of Sheffield in England, had done some measurements on how well a professional athlete could kick a ball, basically, the human performance aspect of that. So there was research out there on how much margin of error we had for a top athlete. So, a Beckham approaching the ball that wants to kick it 2 inches off center to the right or whatever. How much margin of error did that athlete have? So we imagine all the different amounts of error that the athlete could have. How much left or right of the spot the athlete was aiming for was there? How much up or down, which caused the lift angle coming off the foot to vary? And how much did that affect the spin and speed of the ball? So we calculated all these different kicks, sent them into the computer. We set up a little wall of defenders and put a virtual goalie there. And we had a little target box, and we tried to figure out roughly what the success rate for the kicker to hit that target. And we found about 1 in 10 for a free kick. And one of the things I love about baseball is there are stats for everything. Every single pitch now with PitchFX is charted. So you can go online and get to the PitchFX website, and you can look up, for example, Ervin Santana's no-hitter yesterday for the Angels and figure out what every single pitch did. There is not that quite a statistical anal retentiveness in soccer. And we had a hard time finding really good stats for the success rate there. Just anecdotally, from what we've seen watching games, that seems like it's in the ballpark. Or on the pitch, as it may be.
Yeah. All right, I want to go back one last time to Flutie's pass, and something that you don't discuss in regard to his pass, but you do talk about it later in regards to kicking a soccer ball and also to throwing a discus, is what the athlete does to affect the flight of the object. And so I want to ask you to play quarterback coach. What should a quarterback concentrate on to improve the distance of his passes? Is it the speed of his arm? Is it the strength of his arm and the force that he puts into the ball as he throws it? Is it the angle that he throws it? So what would you recommend based on the physics of a thrown ball for increasing the length of passes that a quarterback throws?
Well, I have been asked that question for over a decade. And the answer that I've always given, and I'm not the first person to give this answer, many scientists I think will give this answer, is spend a lot more time listening to what your coach says than what a physicist tells you. And by that I mean, I can sit here on a computer with a piece of paper and a pencil, and I can calculate exactly what the optimum launch angle is, launch speed, etc., to get the ball from point A to point B. And I can use all the wonderful laws of physics to do that. There are things that I think athletes can learn from sports scientists like myself, because I think information is power, and the more you know, the better you can be. But the overwhelming advice I would give someone is listen to your coach. The coach is going to have all the techniques down and mastered and be able to provide those to the player. Now, what can I say? Well, is it really good to bulk up your arm? Is it really good to be flexible? Why does an arm go dead as you age? I mean, the idea is it's like a spring. You have tendons in your body, make these connections in your body. They store energy like springs. So a pitcher early on in his major league career can throw really hard. And as you age, even if you're spending all these hours in the gym and you're bulking up your arm and you have, phenomenal muscle strength, if you don't have the same flexibility and elasticity in your tendons, you can't store as much energy. So you just can't throw as hard as you get older. I mean, it's why our faces wrinkle as we age. Our skin's just losing elasticity. The spring's getting weaker. So the advice I would say is, maintain a good exercise regimen, a good nutrition regimen, stay toned, stay flexible, don't kill yourself in the gym. But guess what? all those things are exactly what your nutrition coach, your quarterback coach, and your head coach are going to tell you.
Okay. I want to
throw a perfect spiral, of course. I mean, you know, we can talk about the physics behind that and how the hand's got to hold the ball and how the ball's got to be released and the motion and all that. But that's a well-established coaching principle as well. So I'm not sure that even if I explain to a quarterback exactly what the frictional forces involved with the fingertips and exactly the imparting of angular momentum to the ball and all these other fancy physics words, I don't know that that's going to help them more than the coach is.
Yeah. And what you were saying in terms of coaches coaches knowing techniques, and also I was thinking of the intuition of great athletes. You know, especially you were talking you wrote about in the chapter on the Stanford band play. Something I found interesting is the vectors of a lateral. And, you know, I've thrown plenty of laterals, and it's something you just do intuitively on the field, and it works. And yet in reading that section of the chapter, I realized, wow, this is pretty complicated to get a lateral to go when you're running and the other person's running, and you throw a lateral and you have to get it going backward and get it to the target.
That's right. And what a lateral allows me to do is talk about this fancy term, frames of reference. So someone sitting in the stands, just not moving with respect to the field, just watching the game, is in a different frame of reference from the person who's running with the ball. You know, the person running with the ball, it might be dangerous to do it, but if it looks up in the stands while running, would see the stands moving in the other direction. You know, we tend to think of ourselves as at rest, so to speak. When you're 500 miles an hour on an airplane, you're able to walk around the cabin and do things normally that you would on the ground. So you have a sense of being at rest there. Now, when you're running and you're exerting, you know you're moving with respect to the ground. You don't really perceive yourself at rest. But the point is, when you get ready to release that ball while you're running, it's not just good enough to toss it slightly behind you as you're running, because the person sitting in the stands, or more importantly, the referee, if that ball is seen as actually advancing forward, it's not a legal lateral. And the reason that can happen is, and I'll make it even simpler than trying to think of the two-dimensional or even three-dimensional lateral physics, just imagine you're in a van with the back door open, and you're going down the road at, I don't know, 60 miles an hour, and you're standing in the back of the van, and you're holding, you know, a football. And you toss the ball out the back of the van, but it's 30 miles an hour with respect to you. So it would leave your hand at 30 miles an hour if you were standing on the ground and someone measured it with a radar gun. Now, somebody on the side of the ground watching that van go by would see the van going 60 miles an hour in one direction, the ball leaving the player with respect to the player at 30 miles an hour. It's going to look like the ball is going 30 miles an hour in the direction of the van, because we're adding two different velocities here. So the person on the van says, I threw that backwards. The person on the ground says, no, you threw it forwards. Now, both people are right, because they're answering they're addressing that question in their own frames. But what's important in a football game, of course, is, you know, the frame of reference of the field, you know, the stationary field. So, and that's a challenge even for referees, because they are running. Mm-hmm. So they don't have the luxury of sitting there at rest like someone in the stands and judging where the ball moves with respect to them. They have to watch the ball being pitched, note on the field using a line marker or something, some reference, where that ball was released and then where it's caught. So they can't really get caught up in their own moving frame. They're, you know, it's running with them. They have to watch where the ball was pitched and where it was caught, and basically extrapolate out to the fan's viewpoint. It's a challenging thing to do.
Yeah. So I want to turn to some Olympic events, and I want to talk about Bob Beamon's world record long jump in the 1968 Olympics, which you have a chapter about. And one of the big questions, the big controversies about Beamon's jump was how he benefited from the higher altitude at Mexico City. And so that's something that you did analyze. And what did you find with that?
Well, it is true that, you know, the 68 Olympics took place in Mexico City. Now, we also need to keep in mind everybody else was jumping in Mexico City too. Mm-hmm. It's not like they dropped Bob Beamon off in Mexico City and put everybody else, you know, in New York City or wherever close to sea level. So he had about a 2 meter per second wind at his back, and the additional contributions to the air are legal. That's within the legal limit. It's at the apex of the legal limit, but it's still within the legal limit for jumping. And the wind, I think my calculation was a little more than a half a foot. It was about 7 1/4 inches, I believe, that he was able to benefit from Mexico City in the wind.
So he gained a half a foot from the wind. Okay.
And from the altitude. So it is true that the world record would not have been as long. He still would have had the world record.
Okay.
No one would have touched him in that event. You got to subtract that roughly that distance from everybody else as well. But he was his jump was just something that just shocked people. I mean, he just collapsed in disbelief when it was announced.
Mm-hmm. And you have a line on that section where you said Beamon did everything humanly possible while in flight to maximize his landing distance. And so what did he do? How did that affect the physics of his jump?
Well, if you think about watching sports, one of the seductive lures, I think, in watching sports is this belief that the common fan has that, you know, I could do that. I could probably come close to doing that. I could make that shot. I could hit that ball, field that grounder, whatever. When you watch a long jump, you think, okay, what, the guy's just running fast, gets up to this line and jumps. There's an amazing amount of technique involved that if you're not watching closely, you're just going to think the guy runs down and jumps. What happens when you're running, you're mostly upright, and when you get into that pit where you're going to land, if you notice, long jumpers aren't standing up when they land. They're mostly crouched down, and they hit the sand with their feet, and their, you know, bum is very, very close to the ground. So what happens is they have to do something while in the air to reconfigure their body. But what happens is, not only in the air but everywhere else, we're constrained by the laws of physics. So if part of your body moves one way, there has to be some compensation for another part to move another way. So what Beamon did and what athletes do, they throw their arms way back behind them when they're in the air. And there's a beautiful principle in physics called conservation of angular momentum, and it has to do with how things are turning. And people use it to explain motions of galaxies, and they also bring it down into the atomic and nuclear and subatomic, subnuclear world. This is a very important principle in physics. So you put your arms way back behind you. That's a rotation. Well, something else has to rotate. And what it is, it's the legs. The legs rotated forward. So with very strong abdominal muscles, I mean, you know, we don't underestimate the importance of training. I mean, these are toned athletes with incredibly strong abdominal muscles who can force their arms back. Their legs are moving forward. It's like, you know, it's almost like watching a stapler. You know, the top part gets crunched down with the bottom part. So his head and torso start rotating toward his legs, and his legs are rotating up. Now, when he lands, his feet are way forward. He's not anything close to standing up. He's able to go a little extra distance as opposed to just standing up. So he put everything right. He had a little bit of tailwind. He hit the board just right. His technique was just essentially flawless in the air, and he was able to get his feet forward and have a little bit of an extra at a distance at the end because of that beautiful angular momentum conservation idea.
So another Olympic athlete that you analyze in flight is Greg Louganis and his dives. And and one of the questions you ask in that section on Louganis is how fast he is spinning when he's in a tuck position doing somersaults. So how fast was he going around?
So in the tuck, I'm trying to remember here, he was doing three complete turns in about a second and a half. So that takes you down to about two revolutions per second. If you put that in terms of revolutions per minute, that's going to be, 120 revolutions per minute.
Okay.
So, you know, something comparable to, if anyone listening remembers what albums are, we used to play these things at 33 RPMs or 45 or 78, but so this is even faster than that.
Huh. So in that section, you also talk about the physics and water. So you discuss things like water density, displacement, and buoyancy. And in that section, in talking about physics and water, you bring up something that I always think about when I'm watching diving competitions, is why don't they hit the bottom?
Well, the rules for diving, when the water depth has to be about 3.5 meters for the 1 meter springboard, and a little bit more, about 3.8 meters for a 3 meter springboard. Those depths are plenty to ensure that the motion is arrested before the diver's going to get injured hitting the bottom. So what can be done by a physicist, and you're certainly not going to build a pool without doing some calculations first. You're not going to build a car or an airplane or anything else without some scale models, computer models, some kind of calculation. If you know what an athlete can do jumping off of a board and how high that athlete can go, you can calculate roughly how fast the athlete's moving. You can then calculate, you know, the water drag on the athlete, the buoyant force, the weight of the athlete, etc., and figure out about how much depth you're going to need. And then you make the pool a little deeper. You know, you're not going to put it right at the edge. You know, the safety factors that engineers talk about, you go a little bit more. So the depth is plenty deep to make sure that they're not hurt. As soon as you enter the water, you have the largest amount of water drag on you. The faster you go, the more water drag. And then you can make it even larger by putting your arms out, you know, making your area bigger. Going back to the hand out the car window example, if I stick my hand out the window in the airplane wing configuration, I don't feel as much force from the wind as if I turn it 90 degrees and let the wind hit the palm of my hand. So the more area I put in there, the greater the drag, and you can slow down a lot faster that way. So you usually see the athletes not only kind of angle their body a little bit and do a little bit of a curve, but they'll also put their arms out. Maybe their legs will go out a little bit, and they can stop fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm. So they do stop themselves. One thing I was wondering, do you have an idea of if they held that vertical entry position, how far down would they go?
Oh, I think they could touch the bottom. I don't think they'd be moving very fast.
Oh, okay.
I mean, when if you're at a public pool, you can jump off the diving board and you know, maintain a nice aerodynamic dived position into the water and make it to the bottom. But you're not moving fast enough to really hurt yourself. Now, you'll notice when you go to pools, in the 3-foot section, they'll have a sign that says no diving. Because if you don't know that as soon as you enter the water, you need to pull your arms out or your legs out, increase your area there, then it's not deep enough to slow you down enough and you can get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So those signs aren't there just to be annoying.
So you have another chapter devoted to the Tour de France, and with that you do something interesting. Rather than simply explaining what happens, what the athletes are doing, in that chapter you make a model in order to predict the times for stages of the race. So how did you create this model for predicting stage times?
Well, one of the great things about being a physics professor at a college like Lynchburg College is I get to teach a course called computational physics, and I give students the chance to do projects instead of taking final exams in that course. And I had a student named Ben Hannes who came up with an idea of doing something with cycling, and we had done some basic bicycle modeling in during the course. And when his project rolled around, he wanted to do something with a stage of the Tour de France. And after the course ended, I said, hey, let's try this for the whole race. And he had a few little kinks in it, and we got those ironed out, and we did a literature search, and we tried to figure out, you know, how much can a biker input power into the bike? You know, what's the physiology here? What kind of air drag does a biker feel? What kind of friction does the tire have on the road? And, you know, we thought about all these different factors that influence cycling. And then we took terrain data that exists on the Tour de France website. They will put stages. There are 21 stages, and they'll put the stage data for each stage. And you can see how far the biker's gone at a certain point and the elevation. And not to drag up something from your university physics days, but you can make an inclined plane with that. And that's an absolutely standard problem that every first semester physics student solves.
I think I was able to do that, actually.
And really, that's all you need to set it up. And we just put a whole series of these inclined planes together and did this for the entire race. And what we did was we started off our cyclist on a bike there at the beginning and put the human power input in, got them going, and asked the computer, how long does it take to get to the end of the stage? Now, in today's world, this was back in 2003 that we did this. In today's world, we've got Google Earth and other things where we can even get more points. But at that time, we did that for the entire race in 2003. We did it again the next couple of years. And then I did it just in these past 3 weeks with the 2011 race. And we get pretty close. We get within a few percent. This year, I had 6 stages I was able to predict under 1%. And only one bad stage. I'm still trying to figure out stage 16 of this past year's race, but everything else we didn't have an error more than 8%.
Okay.
So it's a thrill. I mean, every single day you have this prediction out there, and to see him come in and get pretty reasonable guess is it's very thrilling. Knows physics works.
Yeah, and we will link to your blog from the website, and I did follow it, and I was reading your blog entries, and it is quite fascinating. And so what is the one stage that throws you? So is it stage 16 that you have trouble with? Why is that a problem?
It threw me because when the time came in, I had about a half an hour or so too slow. And when I looked at the stage, except for two little portions at the end, the whole stage is almost all uphill, and it rained. And the average speed on that stage was greater than the average speed for any other stage that had been run to that point, except for the little short team time trial in stage 2. So it looked to require a lot of power beyond what was in my model. So I'm still thinking about that one and trying to figure out exactly what the issue was there. Mm-hmm.
So as you said, the modeling of doing an incline is something that, as I said, I remember doing it in my freshman physics class. But the tricky part is the force, correct? Of figuring out how much force the biker and his bike brings into the equation.
Well, we have a pretty good model of what the air does on an object. We have a pretty good idea of what air resistance is doing. Mm-hmm. It's hard to explain the details, but we have a good phenomenological model of air resistance. We have a pretty good understanding of what the tire is doing with the road, and we know the earth is pulling on the cyclist and the bike. That's what we all call our weight, and we know the road's pushing back on the cyclist perpendicular to the road, and really that's about it. And once we have some basic understanding of those forces, we set up our freshman physics inclined plane and put good old Newton's laws into action and solve the problem.
So I realized I used the wrong term. So the correct term would be power, correct?
Well, the amount of power that the cyclist is able to put in is in a very important number. The model is very sensitive to that. It's amazing how many calories these cyclists can burn. I mean, they can burn upwards of 5,000 calories in a given stage, for some of the longer stages. And they have to eat while they're on their bike. They do other restroom-type breaks while they're on their bike. Sometimes they will receive coaching or, encouragement from fans. This past year, someone got knocked into some barbed wire in a very unpleasant-looking video. A lot of things happen during the race that we just can't possibly put into our model. I don't know when it's going to rain. Mm-hmm. There are weather factors that are difficult to put in. So, we do the best we can, and turns out it's working pretty well. Hmm.
So, and you get quite a bit of interest in your blog for your predictions of the race?
I was very humbled and very flattered that right now the count, I believe, is 24 countries. People from 24 countries have at least, someone in one of those countries has checked out the blog. That's what my stats page tells me.
So this modeling of the Tour de France to predict stage times is one example. I guess we can call it applied physics in sports. But you do mention in the book the ways that an understanding of physics is used in designing equipment and in training. And from my layman's perspective, it seems as this has become a more prominent part of sports in, say, the last 15, 20 years. And I'm thinking of the design of golf clubs and the design of body suits for swimmers. So I'll ask you, as a physicist, is there a noticeable increase in the number of scientists and engineers and the application of science in sports?
Yes, there is. In fact, I would encourage any young listener who's interested in sports science to think about Lynchburg College as an option and come work with me and do some sports physics. And I'm not the only one out there. A very simple internet search could take you to scores of other people working in this field very quickly. And the thing about golf, its rules are not constrained as anywhere near like what baseball is. You read about how a baseball is constructed. It is not the same thing in golf. There's more flexibility with how the club is designed. And as people develop new materials, the modeling gets better. Even the video technology, high definition, high frame counts per second, ways of actually visualizing what's going on, computer modeling, as the computer industry continues to give us faster processors and more efficient ways of handling codes and all this, we can simulate things on a computer much faster and better than we could 10 years ago. So we can put cyclists into a computer and run wind over them and see what the wind's doing all on the computer without ever having to subject a rider to a wind tunnel or anything. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that can be done making use of new technologies that allow us to keep inching records, breaking records and, getting more and more out of human performance. Mm-hmm.
So we're almost out of time, but let me ask you, in your research and in your ongoing work, what sport or what particular move in a sport, in a competition, do you find most challenging to analyze and explain as a physicist? So I guess what requires you to do the most complicated equations?
Well, certainly any time you're trying to incorporate air resistance. Mm-hmm. As I said, we've got reasonable phenomenological models of that. If you're really trying to understand what goes on with the air moving around a soccer ball, then we have to do more sophisticated things. We need more sophisticated equations. And that is a part of my research right now. We've done dust experiments. We've looked at balls in wind tunnels and trying to understand exactly what happens. And things are very strange when you get right down to the surface of the ball. And just to give you a fast example, if you've ever had a ceiling fan and you've noticed it's dusty, and you think, well, I'll just get rid of that dust, I'll flip it on high, and you do that and you let it run a few minutes and you turn it off and you find the dust is still there. And the reason is, when air starts moving over objects, it gets stuck to the surface a little bit. There's a little cushion, a little layer there, that doesn't really have a lot of air moving on it. And that's why you have trouble, you can't blow that dust off your ceiling fan. And that happens on soccer balls and cricket balls and baseballs and other projectiles in sports. You have to really find clever ways to analyze exactly how that air is moving over the ball and how it gets peeled off the ball and other fascinating things like that. These are active areas of research.
Huh. And so then one last question. Is there an individual athletic feat that in your research, whether something in the book or something else you've looked at, that just left you amazed? Perhaps something where a human stretched his or her body to the limit or close to the limit of what is physically possible.
Usain Bolt, watching Usain Bolt run makes my jaw drop. Uh-huh. It takes me a while before I could put my physicist cap on and think about it. He's got an ideal body size for that, and he's able to maximize the gifts that he was given, and he's just shattering records left and right in 100 meters. Watching Michael Phelps swim, again, it's somebody who's maximizing the body they were given and able to, the way he's able to swim and the dolphin kicking and other things are just phenomenal to watch.
So you mentioned now that my last question is, what are you working on now? And you briefly mentioned you're working on the flight of soccer balls.
That's right. I still have some research collaboration with my colleague back in England, and we've been looking at how the air separates off of soccer balls, and trying to look at the different types of soccer balls and understand exactly what's going on down right next to the surface of the ball. And these are very interesting fluid mechanics questions that go even beyond just the sports world.
So then, and going back all the way to the beginning when you introduced yourself, I have to ask, I've heard it said that hitting a ball, a pitched ball with a baseball bat, is one of the hardest things to do in all of sports. So you talked about moving out of baseball into physics because you found it easier to do. So how hard is it from a physics standpoint to hit a pitched ball?
Well, a major league fastball is going to take about 4/10 of a second to reach home plate. Now, it has been demonstrated through some good research that the human eye actually cannot track the ball at each point of its motion along that 0.4 seconds of time that it takes the ball to get from pitcher's hand to the plate. So we say, coaches always say, keep your eye on the ball. You can in places, but your brain cannot do it that quickly. You cannot track the ball at every point along that path. There's a lot to be said for practice, for muscle memory. You know, your brain is a very powerful organ. I mean, it can calculate things very quickly. So we get where's the pitcher's release point? A few, images of the ball coming in, and we have a pretty good idea of where to swing. But that was challenging. I wasn't a bad hitter, but, you start moving up the ranks and you realize you got to be really at the elite level to think about making a living playing baseball.
Well, so going back to your introduction and talking about your enthusiasm for both sports and physics, this was really quite apparent throughout the book, which made it enjoyable to read. Your enthusiasm for both subjects was clear. And despite my own limitations in physics, I learned a lot from your book. And one measure of a good book is how often you read things out loud to other people sitting in the room. And I read quite a few passages from your book to both my wife and my kids. So thank you again for taking time to come on New Books and Sports to talk about your work.
Well, I appreciate that. It's very flattering, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with John Eric Goff, author of Gold Medal Physics, The Science of Sports, published in 2009 by the Johns Hopkins University Press. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers more than 70 channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from South Asian studies to psychology and political science to popular culture. If you like what you heard here, please link to the Facebook page for New Books in Sports, where you can give us your feedback, get announcements of new interviews, and find links to thoughtful sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening, and enjoy your week.